Campus Fellowship. It exists to equip local churches to implement and sustain dynamic college ministries with a common mission to make disciples of Jesus Christ who worship God and change the world. My name is Jacob Bennett, and I serve as the executive director. With us today is Jacob Vansickle, pastor of Sacred City. Go ahead and say hi, Jake.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, so it might be a little confusing for those who don't know about the two Jakes in Campus Fellowship, but we trust that you can figure it out. And with us today is Aaron Wren. And Aaron Wren is the author of a new book called Life in the Negative World. And Aaron, you know, this book was very impactful in when I read it, and it like a lot of light bulbs went on. But before we dive into the book, can you just share with people like what it is that you do, and you know, how God led you into this? I'm sure your job description, like people would be, you know, our students don't have any idea what your job description would look like.
Well, it's very interesting because I've always been in that situation. I've actually had three careers. First, relative to the book, I grew up in rural southern Indiana and was raised in a sort of culture war Assemblies of God church there. So that was my background. Went to college and then moved to Chicago and spent career number one doing management consulting, mostly with Accenture there. And people at Accenture always used to say, you know, the hardest part of your job is explaining to your parents exactly what it is you do. What does a consultant do? And I don't think I have time to explain that today because it's complicated. Then I did a pivot and ended up in doing urban policy. So I kind of applied the consulting analytic framework to the problem of cities. Having grown up in a rural area, I was fascinated with cities. So ended up at the Manhattan Institute in New York, which is a think tank there. And then, you know, as an adult, kind of urban Christian, was more in the Presbyterian world the world that I might call cultural engagement from the standpoint of my book. We can talk about that. And then I sort of did a second pivot into writing, originally focused on men's issues in the church. I saw that young men were turning in droves, millions of them actually, to online influencers. You know, Jordan Peterson being the biggest, but there are plenty of others. They're not going to the church. What's going on with that? So I wanted to engage on that issue. And then it sort of broadened out from there to a little bit of the future of the evangelical church. So I am a journalist. I am a senior fellow at American Reformer, which is a Protestant nonprofit. You can go to AmericanReformer.org and check that out. And then I also do, you know, various other things that many journalists do. So I do my writing for my own Substack, AaronWren.com. Please go sign up. And I also write for magazines and newspapers and things of that nature. And I also do speaking engagements. People will ask me to come speak to the thing. I do a lot of podcast interviews like this. So, you know, this is my job, you know, to show up on things like this, you know, get spreading the word about what I'm doing. And I do kind of a little bit of ancillary consulting here and there. I still do some work in the city space as well. In fact, last year I did a big study on the future of Appalachia. And one of the paradigms that I came up with, ironically, is just in a big article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, basically makes the same argument that I did, although they didn't quote me. But mine was in print first, so I got that one. That's what I do.
I also want to make a plug for your material and your Substack. I think I've been reading you since Rod Dreher reposted your original Three Worlds article. And if you're not subscribed, you should. Like, all of them are very valuable and out of the box. You know, it's, you're not regurgitating what other people are doing, just out of the box.
You know, the reality is I should do more regurgitation because people read me and probably come away with the impression that I'm much more unconventional than I actually am, because I sort of take the position of, you know, if other people are already saying this stuff, you don't need me to say it. You know, there's sort of people who are like Me Too kind of people. It's like, okay, I'm going to say the same thing everybody else is saying, but I'm going to do it like in a unique style or a unique voice or something like that. And that's how people are going to read me. There's different strategies for media. I like to give new perspectives. And so when you give new perspectives, you know, people think that you're like a collection of new perspectives, when really the only things that I'm writing are the things where I have something new and distinct versus cool. that. So,
well, keep it up.
Yeah. My wife has recently read the book Strong Town. So when you're talking about urban cities and stuff like that, my mind is like, oh, wow. Like,
yeah, I know Chuck Marone, who wrote that book.
Yeah.
I like the Strong Towns guys a lot.
Yeah, no, that's good. And if this was a podcast about that, maybe I'd dig in a little bit more, because I'd be interested to hear maybe some of your thoughts. But I haven't read the book yet, but I'm hoping to. So, but maybe shifting it to what you wrote about, so Life in a Negative World, can you describe just what is the positive world, the neutral world, the negative world? And can you describe it for someone who, like, maybe they began high school in like 2019.
Well, that might be a little hard. It's very difficult to relate to the world prior to the time you were kind of born and conscious in a little bit. And I'll give you a couple tips on life here for a college audience. One is, anything that happened before you were born seems like it happened like in the far distant past. Where the things that happened in the past, but within your sort of memory in a lifetime, seem like they were just yesterday. So in the 1980s, when I was in high school and junior high, Ronald Reagan was the president, and there was a huge amount of discussion about the Vietnam War. So like the post-Vietnam era was huge. You know, Bruce Springsteen song Born in the USA and all that stuff. It's just like, I'm like, man, you know, the Vietnam War, that was a long time ago. And like, the reality is that the Vietnam War had really, Saigon had really fallen less than 10 years ago. And the Vietnam War was like 15, it wasn't that long ago. And so, but to me, like, Vietnam happened, like, that happened a long time ago. Actually, it didn't. It happened just before I could remember it. And whereas Ronald Reagan, like, oh yeah, Ronald Reagan, that wasn't that long ago. Ronald Reagan, like, was 40 years ago, 34 years ago. It was a long time ago, right? It's like, you know, as I say, it's like, you know, it's further from Reagan to today than it was from Reagan to Eisenhower, you know, thinking back the other direction. And so we have a warped, one thing I would just say, if you're a young person, is to be aware of the warped perceptions of time that you have on that. And it's very difficult to relate to any cultural milieu you did not experience. And I'm just like that. I can't tell you about what it was like in the Depression. I can't tell you what it was like to live in the 1950s directly, because I don't have experience of it. So it does become hard to realize, like, what did America used to be? And I will say, like, if you're like in high school in 2019, your experience of America, your America, is in many ways a completely different country than my America. Whereas my America actually isn't that different from my dad's America. There really was a sort of, call it mass culture America, that really got going with Hollywood and radio in maybe the, you know, 20s and 30s, as we sort of had this national culture start to develop, as, you know, you had like network programs and things where people started to tune in. And it really took off with the post-war era in television. So like from 1945 to 1990, 95, that period was dominated by a sort of mass common consumer culture. So there were, you know, just three basic TV networks, mass market products. I mean, so like, you know, maybe some of your guys are not yet old enough to drink beer. But like in the 1980s, there were basically three brands of beer in America: Miller, Bud, and Coors. There were fewer than 100 breweries in the United States of America in 1980. So like, this explosion of choice didn't exist. It was basically like a very common culture country. And, you know, so the world today is very different. It's very different. We've had a disruption. That sort of 50 to 75 year run of what I call mass consumer culture, mass media culture America, really broke up in the 1990s and has been dissolving ever since. So that's all the preamble that I would say. But yeah. what I would say is, if you think about American history, we never had a state church like they did in Europe. But for most of our history, we did have a certain softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion. So if you go back to the 1950s, half of all adults attended church every Sunday. That was actually the high watermark of church attendance in America. We had prayer and Bible reading in public schools. We were adding "In God We Trust" to our money and "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. So it was a sort of Christian normative country. In the 60s, that started to become unraveled. Christianity went into decline in America, and it's a decline that continues to the present day. And I divide that period of decline from 1964 to today into three eras or worlds that I call the positive world, the neutral world, and the negative world. The positive world was from 1964 to 1994. And this is a period of decline of Christianity. I want to be clear about that. Things are not going well. You know, church attendance is down, things of that nature. Nevertheless, society was basically still positive towards Christianity. To be known as a good church-going man made you seem like an upstanding member of society, right? The moral norms of Christianity were the basic moral norms of society. About 1994, we had a tipping point. We enter what I call the neutral world. Christianity is not seen positively anymore, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's just one more lifestyle choice among many in a sort of pluralistic public square. You know, Christian moral norms had some sort of residual effect. Then in 2014, we had a second tipping point where, for the first time in the 400-year history of America, official elite culture now views Christianity negatively, or certainly at least skeptically. Maybe skeptically is a better way to put it. You can merely identifying as a Christian does not get you in trouble. What gets you in trouble is holding any views that conflict with the new public morality. Talk more about that if you'd like. So all throughout American history, I mean, there were lots of people, including top leaders, like many of our founding fathers, who were not exactly like devout Orthodox Christians, but they felt compelled to hold Christianity in public honor. That's what's different about today. It's Christianity is sort of held in a little bit of public dishonor. You know, to be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job in the elite sectors of the economy. Christian morality is now expressly repudiated and, in fact, is viewed as the leading threat to the new public moral order. And so that's been a really dislocating experience for a lot of people, you know, of my generation or the boomer generation who grew up in different eras in America, in that old American culture. It might actually be a better experience for Gen Z, because they haven't known any other America. Therefore, they're not suffering this sense of loss and alienation that many older people find. You know, one of the things that I have noticed about Gen Z, and there's been a lot written about Gen Z's social dysfunctions, and there's a lot of them, okay? You know, the mental health issues, you know, for example. You know, Jonathan Haidt just has a new book out about how smartphones have really caused huge problems for that. But, you know, what I find is among a certain segment of Gen Z, an incredible optimism about the future, even among Gen Z Christians. And Rod Dreher, you know, had the same experience in Europe, where it's like, you know, Europe has sort of been a post-Christian country for a while, but like the young trad Catholics in France, like they're actually feeling pretty good. They're feeling pretty optimistic. And I think there is a sense, if you don't live through the decline, you see opportunities with new eyes. And so I live in the Midwest, and a lot of my work around cities focused on the Rust Belt. And people who lived through the decline of Rust Belt cities, who knew essentially like the factories closing, you know, the department stores where your mother took you in white gloves for tea, and, you know, the places where you went when you were in high school, they're all closed, all gone. And you see the decay and beautiful buildings boarded up. You have, again, this narrative of a loss. Whereas if you go for people who are the millennials, for example, they had a completely different experience of the city. Cities sort of hit their bottom point probably in the 70s, really. They were still pretty bad in the 80s. By the mid-90s, cities are on the way up.
Yeah.
So millennials only ever experienced the cities they live in rising and getting better. They actually had a very positive like view of cities. They weren't dealing with this. It's like, wow, things are just getting better here every day. Look at that new coffee shop that opened. Look at that new microbrewery. Look at that new apartment building. It's a completely different narrative of, you know, of the city. So I think Gen Z, I think the opportunity for young people, for people in college today, is that you're not laden with the baggage of decline. Mm-hmm. And you can see the world with fresh eyes and see the opportunities of the future in a way that people who are kind of like, maybe my generation can't.
Can you explain then maybe how have Christians, so sort of like for the 19-year-old the person who started high school in 2019, how have Christians, like from your generation and onward, engaged in culture and in the positive and neutral worlds? And then we can talk about engaging in the negative world kind of later, but how have Christians traditionally engaged culture?
Well, Christians is a very broad term. So if you go back to the 1950s, America was dominated by essentially the mainline denominations. And, candidly, they were, in a sense, you might even describe them as Christian nationalists. Okay, they're building a national and international order built around essentially American Protestant values. Now, they might have been liberal Protestant values, but, when you talk about the old WASP establishment, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment, that's what those guys were. So you can look at a guy like John Foster Dulles. So if you ever fly to Washington, D.C., and fly into Dulles Airport, it's named after John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State, was it under Eisenhower? I can't remember which one it was under. But, he did things like negotiate the treaty that ended World War II with Japan, like peace treaties and all that stuff, and, help, build a lot of the post-war order. And a guy like that, who was, raised in a Presbyterian home, very active in the Presbyterian church on the modernist side of the fundamentalist modernist controversy. Back when it was, the Episcopalians were the Republican Party at prayer. A lot of people from the upper tiers of society were part of that. That was a kind of form of cultural engagement. My book, and of course, Catholics have their own different ones. So I really focus on evangelicals and looking at this period of, positive, neutral, negative world. And what I just basically argue is that there are sort of three main strategies or approaches that evangelicals took. Two in the positive world, one in the neutral world. In the positive world, we had culture war and seeker sensitivity. And in the neutral world, we had cultural engagement. So the culture war is basically the religious right. These are people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who in the late 70s and into the 80s, they didn't like the way the culture was going. So they decided to mobilize, to fight back, to take back the country, that sort of thing. And of course, the evangelicals were originally Democrats. I think people don't realize that. Jimmy Carter was the first evangelical president. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of concern in a number of quarters about what it would mean for this Bible thumper, Jimmy Carter, to be the president. But really, in the 1980s, they realigned to the Republican Party. And of course, the kind of religious right culture war still with us. Seeker sensitivity also sort of got its start in the 1970s with people like Bill Hybels at Willow Creek Church in suburban Chicago, or Rick Warren at Saddleback Church in Orange County in the early 1980s. And what these people did was they saw that church attendance was in decline. So their response was, why don't we just create a church people actually want to attend? So the origin story of Willow Creek is that Bill Hybels went door to door in suburban Chicago asking people why they didn't go to church. And as he said, put it, I got an earful. And so then, they designed churches people would attend. And this became essentially the non-denominational suburban megachurch that we all know. It's, again, it tends to downplay denominational distinctives, even if they're in a denomination. Saddleback Church was technically in the Southern Baptist Convention. Not that you would ever really have known that for most of its history. They didn't really talk about that. Mm-hmm. That it's informal dress, it's contemporary music, it's topical therapeutic sermons, lots of programming for families, all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, they're still with us. That's still basically, I think, the evangelical mainstream in a lot of ways. Then in the neutral world, the cultural engagement strategy came along, really pioneered by people like Tim Keller at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. And I think there are a couple ways to think about cultural engagement. One is as a seeker sensitivity for the cities. Cities were coming back in the 1990s, again, as I was saying, in the early 1990s, there were like 2,000 murders a year in New York. It was a war zone. People thought New York was done. Rudy Giuliani comes in, now, like not long ago, there were fewer than 300 murders right in New York. So it was like massive reductions in crime. People pour into the cities, and these people were reaching the urban demographic. Now, the second way to think about it is the opposite of the culture war. Rather than fighting with people all the time, why don't we have a conversation with people and do all of that stuff? And so, again, this was kind of the urban church movement, and maybe the college. I think the college Christian environment really is of pretty much in this vein, is from what I can tell as well. Tends to be upscale, educated, intellectual, artistic, taking its cues in many respects from the culture as opposed to fighting with it. So all of the concern about, racial justice, for example, that did not originate in the evangelical church. That originated, they had the so-called Great Awakening, for example, in 2014. You could listen to any secular analyst or researcher talk about that, and the church sort of went along with it. So it's sort of, similar to the seeker sensitivity in that way. It's going along with the currents of the culture. And so all three of those are still with us today. Now, that's not a completely exhausted list. There are other people like the Neo-Anabaptists, for example, they kind of fit, they're kind of their own little thing. There are different groups here and there. And not everybody fits cleanly into one of those. But I think those three impulses are ones people will recognize as what happened in those eras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think in your book, you even point to a few of those subsets of Christianity that were in their own little negative bubble in the midst of a positive and neutral world. And in your book, you help to explain how we can learn something from how they practice their Christian faith. And I found that very helpful.
When it comes to the neutral world of let's have a conversation, when I was reading your book, I thought back to when I was a college ministry worker, when the Supreme Court ruled on gay marriage, 2014, right? And I remember initially, 2015. And I remember thinking, this is my knee-jerk reaction. We should have a round table and get different perspectives and then invite students to come hear us talk about the different perspectives. That was my knee-jerk reaction to what should happen. And I look back, I'm like, I would never do that now. It's like, but that was a very neutral world way of thinking. It was a very cultural engagement way of thinking. And just to hit on your point, that's the way people would think.
Yeah.
But we want to transition. In your book, you get very practical towards the second half of your book, towards individuals, different institutions, and then how to engage missionally. And we would like to zoom in on each of those three themes towards the people that we mainly serve. So first with individual, you have a chapter on excellence. What does it mean to be excellent, pursuing excellence? And of all the people that would actually matter that would read your book, it's probably Gen Z and the generation coming up after Gen Z, where it have the biggest impact because they actually have the time to make some changes. Yeah. A lot of your readers are like, oh, that would have been a good idea 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So imagine you're speaking to a group of college students and explain to them how they can pursue excellence.
I think there's a couple ways to think about that. First off, the degree of difficulty dial on life has just been turned up. So when I graduated from high school, I just said, I took the SAT, and then it's like, it's time to apply for colleges. So I started applying for colleges, and I got in, and I got some scholarships, and I probably could have gone anywhere I wanted. Yes, it was competitive to get into certain schools, but the reality is it was pretty straightforward to go to a good college. That's not the case today. It's hyper-competitive to get into a top college. It's also much, much more expensive to go to college. It's a lot harder to get married and stay married. There's just a lot of things about life that are harder today. And, when you're in a more difficult environment for young people, how hard is it to buy a house? Pretty hard. When you're in that environment, you can't afford to be average, I hate to say it, but that's kind of the case. In fact, economist Tyler Cowen pretty famous guy, writes the Marginal Revolution site. He wrote a book called Average is Over. And it's just like the middle class is getting chewed up. People are either becoming part of the upper middle class or, you know, wealthy. Those groups have expanded, or you're getting proletarianized. And so the kind of middle is dissolving. And so if you're just a young person today, you can't afford to just drift through life the way people my generation did, thinking it would pretty much be okay. It requires a high degree of intentionality towards what you're doing, and you have to be good, right? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, let's be honest. Women have very high standards, you know, for men. So if you're a guy, you think, oh, I'll get married. If you want to get married, you got to be a baller kind of a little bit. You know, and vice versa, you know, women think that, oh, I'm just, you know, just being like a really good Christian girl, it's not going to get you married today. You know, and that's one of the things I say, it's like, just like getting into college, getting a career, moving to the city you want, there has to be like high degree of intentionality towards life in general.
Yeah.
If you want to get what you want in terms of like marriage and kids and things like that, it's not just going to happen. So that's the one thing I'd say. The other thing was, I was kind of inspired by a very famous book written by a historian named Mark Knoll 30 years ago called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. The scandal being that there didn't seem to be one. And, you know, I really see tremendous like Catholic envy among a lot of young evangelicals. I mean, a lot of, you know, more intellectually oriented evangelicals convert to Catholicism precisely because they view kind of Protestantism as, you know, it's anti-intellectual. There aren't as many smart people there. And in fact, you know, even evangelicals have outsourced a lot of their thinking to Catholics, to be quite honest. There's like a line, I don't know if I quoted it in the book, Chuck Colson, who started Prison Fellowship, the old Nixon guy, you know, he was an evangelical. And Richard John Newhouse, who founded First Things magazine, which is this kind of high-tone Catholic, it's basically a Catholic magazine. They publish, you know, they publish Jews and evangelicals, things like that, but it's basically a Catholic magazine. He was a Lutheran priest who converted to Catholicism, became a Catholic priest. You know, Chuck Colson apparently said to him one time, you supply the ideas, we supply the votes. Meaning Catholics come up with the idea, evangelicals are the vote bank. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, anybody with two brain cells who thinks they have some ideas to contribute to society is not going to be very pleased with that arrangement. And so I think there needs to be much more of a space for intellectualism within the Protestant realm.
Yep.
And, you know, I think, you know, I think that the mythos of Catholic intellectualism is a little overstated. you know, but they certainly do a very good job of cultivating and promoting their intellectuals. Mm-hmm. Evangelicalism, I don't want to go into it all today, but the social dynamics of evangelicalism are not conducive to that sort of thing. And I don't think that's going to change. But I think as an individual, you know, one of the things that I try to model in some my own way is what does it mean to be a Protestant public intellectual in America? Mm-hmm. That you don't have to become a Catholic to have an impact. And in fact, it's you know, my book was based on an article in First Things magazine called The Three Worlds of Evangelicalism. It was probably certainly the biggest and highest impact article of the decade in that magazine. And so, you know, I, as a Protestant, was able to write that article. You know, you don't have to be a Catholic to have insights into the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, too often, I think Protestants are not fully mobilizing the talents that they have in applying them to things like that. I think we do have things to say. We sort of need to reinvigorate that. And I have a whole chapter in the book on that.
Yeah. And, I want you to speak a little bit to those that are ministering to them. So college ministry workers who are giving their lives to pour into these students and wanting to see excellence brought out of these students. What are some ways that they can help with that, especially in a negative world environment where, you know, people aren't getting any points by becoming a Christian? In fact, they're going to lose a lot of points, both in the classroom and in their peer circles. And just speak into if you had a room of college ministry workers, what would you say? You can either speak to convincing people in a negative world, or if you want to speak into the whole dating scene of just how excellence is affecting that as well? Feel free.
That's a great question. I don't claim to know exactly how to do college ministry today. What are the concerns of Gen Z? I mean, I think it would be a little bit more than I could say. I would say look at the people who are succeeding at influencing the youth. And, you know, I think if you look at a guy, there's a guy, kind of an infamous online influencer named Andrew Tate, which, you know, I'm sure your viewers have heard of him. To me, Tate is really, his appeal is like high school and middle school boys. Okay, he is not someone that a 28-year-old men are really taking their cues from that. But again, I would look up, so I don't think that's there, but I would take a look at Jordan Peterson. You know, Jordan Peterson just literally had a tweet. I wish I wrote it down. I'd share it with you. Like, you are morally obligated to try to achieve great things in life. And he went through why that was. Like, when's the last time that a Christian pastor ever told you that, like, you are morally obligated to produce at a very high level? Another guy I think who's really good at that is Jocko Willink. He's a former Navy SEAL. He wrote the book Extreme Ownership. Super popular guy, and just like talks about that stuff all the time. One of his mantras is discipline equal freedom. So one thing I might suggest is look at the things people are saying and doing and how they're resonating at other people. It is amazing to me personally how little interest in Jordan Peterson there has been among pastors, and very little. You know, he came in and he like ate our lunch, and wouldn't you want to understand how he did that? Like, and that's what I mean. Like, evangelicalism is an incredibly insular culture, and this idea that like we might learn something from Jordan Peterson, to be like, the Bible's got the answer to everything. And it's like, it's very, you know, the term, I guess, du jour is biblicist. It's like everything, if it can't be tied directly to a scripture in the Bible, then we don't want to talk about it. Or, you know, and yeah, I get attacked all the time over this. You know, he's saying this and, you know, that there's nothing about the Bible in there. It's everything's got to be about the Bible. You know, and the Bible's great, but the Bible, like, the Bible is not the all-purpose guide to life. There is literally nothing in the Bible about dating. There isn't. And when people try to make the Bible about dating, you end up with a purity culture, Joshua Harris, things go wrong. And so there has to be a space for like the Christian scientist or like the Christian lay vocations. And, you know, the idea that you're providing these expertise that, it is not intended in any way to be authoritatively biblical. It's not spiritual teaching, but it's like, you know, helping people in life. I mean, imagine if the doctor said, you know, you went to your doctor and it's like, well, I can't help you with this thing because there's no, you know, unless there's a verse in the Bible that tells me how to treat this illness, I got to go back to Leviticus and look at how they talked about leprosy or something like that. You'd think that guy was crazy. But when it comes to cultural and other matters, like that's how people operate. And so I think we have to open our aperture a little bit. And I, you know, I'd look to like, who's doing a good job of reaching these people and why are they being successful? And that doesn't mean you have to copy their ideas. You know, Jordan Peterson's Jungian claptrap is like not something that we should be adopting, but there's a lot you could learn from that guy. And as near as I can tell, most of the church is completely uninterested in doing that. And so, that's what I would say. Look for those guys, particularly like Peterson and Jocko, I think are two guys to look for.
Yeah, to chime in there, you know, I've been meeting with young men for a decade solid, just trying to interact with what they need and what is the next step for them. And the desire of what they want to talk about has shifted dramatically. And I think a lot of the, what does it mean to be a man? How do you work hard? How do you find a woman? Those things have always been there, but even more so now, I think because of lack of father leadership, because of lack of resource. And just recently, last week, I sent someone a documentary by Michael Foster on It's Good to Be a Man. And I was thinking to myself, I probably would have never sent that a decade ago because I didn't think it would be a good apology. This guy's not a Christian. He's really just investigating things for the first time. But to him, it was pure gold. Even though because it's like, oh, finally someone's talking about what I care about. You know, there's a, If you were to give a, I always tell college ministry workers to have a book on them because college students cancel so often, so always have something to do. You know, if you were to put books in the backpack of for them to read when that arises, what books should they be reading that would help them with this?
Yeah, it's a great question. To be honest, I don't have great book recommendations. When I look at the books, I wish I could say, here's the 20 books you should read.
You can just say one book. This is
Life in the Negative World. Yeah, you know, I do try to distill it down. Like, I will say, you know, I loved like Charles Taylor's The Secular Age. That book is 950 pages long and ultra dense. I did a reading group, led a reading group of that one time, and we took a year to get through it. Okay, so I don't want to tell people, buy this book. You know, I don't like to recommend long books. I do think, I think the guy I think is really super interesting is Nassim Taleb.
Yep.
And he's most famous for a book called The Black Swan, which seemed to predict the 2007 financial crash. And he's got a couple books. One is called Fooled by Randomness, and the other is called Anti-Fragile. I think they're both excellent reads, incredibly provocative ways of thinking about the world. And although he doesn't talk about it in a Christian register, I think they're actually quite aligned with, in many respects, a Christian worldview. So those are good. The other thing I like about Taleb, who became independently wealthy as an options trader, so he can say and do whatever he wants, and he's one of the very few people who takes advantage of being independently wealthy to say what he thinks. And you could Google this. It's in one of his other books, but you can Google it because it's online. You should Google an essay called Intellectual Yet Idiot. And one of the things about him that I think is really important is he basically doesn't have a lot of respect for the elites in our society. And he talks about why they're like failing us and why they're no good, which I share a lot of his perspectives on that. And I think part of the issue today is we tend to view, you know, we look at what's high status. You know, the New York Times is high status. Harvard is high status. You know, all these things are high status. And they've got this aura of desirability because they're high status. And there is a certain sense of, you know, we need to cut them down to size in people's minds. And, you know, some of that, so it's like, you know, it's very complicated. But, you know, the people who are running our country are doing a terrible job. I just saw an article or a chart in a French publication that listed like all the countries in the West based by how much they spent per person on healthcare. And like we spend like 2.5 times as much as anybody, some crazy number like that. And then it showed life expectancy. And like ours is going down a lot. Like it was the worst showing. Like our life expectancy is now down to like Lithuania grade. And only like one or two other countries, life expectancy went down at all, and only by a tiny amount. So we spend the most, we have life expectancy going down, drug addiction problems, homelessness everywhere. We see all these issues. That doesn't mean like America's a terrible place. There's a lot of great things about this country. And, you know, but like until the high status option loses its aura, you're never going to go right with that. You got to puncture the spell of the high status thing. Oh, I want to be in this club. I want to be invited into this fraternity. I want to be this. This is what I want. We're hardwired for status seeking. And so I think that's healthy in a lot of ways, because in a healthy society, status and honors are aligned with good pro-social behavior. That's not necessarily the case in our society. And so if you want people to do things, we have to puncture the aura of some of that stuff. And so I think some of the online influencers, one of the reasons that they're so successful is that they're able to do that, especially when it comes to dating. They say things like, oh, let me tell you how you really attract a woman. And if you try it and it works, all of a sudden you don't respect the people in the culture all that much. So there's a lot of value in giving people practical advice that works. You know, while being clear that, you know, some of it is just that, it's just advice. It's not spiritual truth and nothing is guaranteed in life. You know what I mean? There's like a lot of that as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Let's transition to the last portion of your book. You, the big pitch at the end is what you call prudential engagement. And let's talk about what you mean by that, but especially apply it to pastors. So the third group that really are engaged with Campus Fellowship are pastors that care about their churches and care about reaching the community, but also care about engaging with the college campus. So how can pastors be prudentially engaged?
You know, I was really thinking here a lot about politics and culture and social. How do we engage out in the world on, yeah. on those type topics? And I think there's been a couple responses to the negative world by evangelicals. The first is essentially to double down on culture war. Mm-hmm. And here's the reality, you know, that I think evangelicals need to wrestle with. Their positions are not popular, right? I think we've seen conclusively that the public wants abortion to be legal. So what do you do when your position on that is clearly a minority position? You know, I mean, like way, I mean, many of these, many evangelical positions are, you know, way minority positions. It's not like they're a 49% minority. You're looking like maybe a 30% minority. Okay. So that's one is you have to think about that. And that's why I mean, you know, you need to be wise. You got to say, you know, you can't literally, I am of the opinion, this is unpopular, that, you know, the evangelical church needs to dial back culture warring a lot because it's unproductive. The second thing, though, that I see, and this is coming a lot out of the cultural engagement crowd, is, you know, what I describe as a sort of Anabaptist influenced, you know, mantra of universal kind of surrender. So you'll see things like this. You'll hear statements like this. Our citizenship is in heaven, not in the United States of America. Don't make an idol out of America. Like, who cares what happens down here? We lose down here. That's another one you'll hear. Mm-hmm. Jesus didn't come to exercise power. Jesus came to give up power. And I think it's very clear the people saying this certainly don't believe it themselves. For one thing, they're not giving up any of their power. In fact, many of them don't appear to be losers. They appear to be quite successful. And they're also aggressively the most aggressive pushers of social justice and other things. Like, they're not retreating from the public square. And so there's this guy, Stephen Wolfe. He wrote the book Case for Christian Nationalism. And, you know, I'm not a Christian nationalist. I've written articles where I basically say, I am not a Christian nationalist. I do think he's really good on, like, analyzing some of the way evangelicals think. And so he said that, like, gospel issue has become the way that these guys control what you're supposed to care about, because they define what's a gospel issue. So they would define something like race as a gospel issue. And therefore, the church is supposed to be super, super, super aggressive on racial justice. But they'll say something like, you know, XYZ over here, this is not a gospel issue, so we should not care about it. So it's sort of highly, I think it's essentially highly selective, highly manipulative, and it's really being pushed by people who are in the cultural engagement camp, who are trying to, you know, kind of, you know, avoid having the eye of Sauron fall on them kind of thing. That's kind of how I view it. And so I think, you know, I don't agree with that either. You know, we have to stay engaged in the world. And the question is, we have to do what prudence just means wisdom. We just have to be smart about how we do it. But I do think we need to also, like, have some degree of, you know, acceptance of the fact that there will be good faith, you know, differences about what that means. There are people who are going to be more culture war than I would like. There are people who are going to be more, you know, this over here than I would like. And I think we need to just, you know, accept that, you know, as long as it seems that it's a result of sort of a good faith process, that we can kind of accept that. We shouldn't try to force people into one particular model, I would say. And that's not to say that the way we engage publicly is, you know, is a matter of indifference. I think we're going to be held accountable for it. So I am not, you know, I'm personally a Republican, but I'm not one of these people that says you must vote Republican. It is a sin to vote Democrat. I can't make that claim. On the other hand, right, however you vote, you are going to be giving an account of what you did. So, you know, you might discover that, oh, yeah, I am going to be judged for the way I voted. And so it's not a matter of indifference either. But I don't think it's like I can tell you exactly what you have to do in something like voting.
Yeah, I would say to bring it down to application steps, applying those to pastors that at least I can see of not being engaged without doing the culture warring is when it comes to the university, you need to know what's going on. Like, I think a lot of pastors don't even know what's happening on the local campus and what people are talking about and what Gen Z is talking about. And then you have to instill bravery because there's so much pressure to not to go along with everything. You have to instill bravery in those people. We're coming up to the time limit. Oh, go
again,
ahead.
Jordan,
no, sorry,
Jordan Peterson. Look at Jordan Peterson. What Jordan, yes. Two things. There were two incidents that made Jordan Peterson famous. The first was back maybe, I don't know, 2016 or 17 or something, when he said, "I will not comply with this mandatory pronoun law in Canada." The second was when he went on the UK's Channel 4 in 2018 and faced down this very hostile interviewer. And I highly encourage everyone to watch that. It's like a 30-minute interview. You can go to YouTube, Jordan Peterson, Channel 4, watch it. It's like, in a sense, a model of cultural engagement. He's holding his ground. He's courageous, but he's not being obnoxious. He's not being a bomb thrower. He has mastery of his material. And, you know, he's not like, oh, he's acting like he's got to do a tap dance to avoid offending anybody's sensibilities. But he's also being calm, holding his frame. And I think that's really something to look at there in terms of modeling. There is a there is an element of courage in that. But courage, I think, too often gets coded as being really, really obnoxious. And those are two different things.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a good example of how if you speak, even just speak things plainly, people will misunderstand and sometimes purposely misunderstand.
Right.
And it's a good training for that as well.
Yep.
So we're coming up to the end of our time. We want to just give you the last word. What's the last word that you would say, you know, outside of go out and buy the book, but what was the last word that you would say?
Yeah. I mean, don't let people like me or baby boomers get you down with doom and gloom. And again, I think that's one of the things I'd say. I mean, you know, the optimism of youth is like a great thing to be. And so if you read my book and you never experience the positive or the neutral world, that's actually a good thing because you're not carrying around the baggage of, you know, if we could only go back to the 1980s. Well, we're not going back to the 1980s. Mm-hmm. The ability to see the world through fresh eyes is powerful.
Yes.
And you can have a, you know, if you're starting from this place, well, like, hey, maybe there's a lot of possibilities. So I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Aaron, for joining us. And listeners, if you guys found this encouraging, please subscribe, follow Aaron on all the different places. Aaron, why don't you just, can you tell people where they can follow you at?
Sure. The most important thing is to go to aaronwren.com and sign up for my newsletter. You know, obviously buy the book Life in the Negative World. And I am on Twitter, Aaron_Wren on Twitter, if you want to check that out.
You got to get on TikTok, Aaron.
You know, I'm not going to get on TikTok. That's what I say.
We're going to have to add so many edits to this of explaining who Bruce Springsteen is.
You know, there's this guy. He's not this guy on the internet. He's not very impressed with Generation Z's knowledge of the world, to tell the truth. He's like, you know, they don't know who Paul McCartney is. You know, they won't get this reference, but he's like, it's not like I'm asking them to remember who the other member of Wham was. it's just like, you know, no, it's just like,
we just immediately lost it. It's like Wham.
Yeah, it's like, but no, I do think there is an element of, you know, if you don't, history is very important. And so there's an advantage to not having that some of those experiences, but the reality is, when you don't know anything about anything, then you are totally vulnerable, and there's that. And if anybody really wants to learn some important, you really want to learn something about the United States of America, I'll give you one more book recommendation. One of my favorite books by an author that highly influenced me. It's academic, but it's very readable. It's got some dry pieces, but some of the deepest insights about America that you will find. It's called Puritan Boston and Quaker Philadelphia. And it's written by a gentleman named E. Digby Baltzell, B-A-L-T-Z-E-L-L. And again, that's probably like some higher level reading for somebody that thinks they're a little like intellectual. That book will tell you a lot. You'll learn a lot about America, from that book.
And listeners, once again, follow Aaron, follow him on his website, subscribe to his newsletter. And if you found this helpful, please share it with a friend. Thank you for joining us, Aaron.